And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Eddie Wu. Eddie is very well known around Australia and the world with regular TV appearances and his own WooTube channel, where his videos on maths have been seen a staggering 18 million times with 340,000 subscribers. Eddie is the head mathematics teacher at Cherrybrook Technology High School in Sydney, and in 2018 Eddie was named local hero and shortlisted as one of the top 10 teachers in the world. Eddie, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Thank you very much for having me, Bill.
So Eddie, with your new book Wu's Wonderful World of Maths, who do you want to reach and inspire with this text?
Yeah, look, I've got distinct groups of people who I had in mind when I was writing this book. The first group is sort of in some ways the obvious one. I'm a high school teacher, and so I have in mind all of those leagues of teenagers around the country, around the world, who perhaps don't really get why they're learning maths, don't really see any purpose in it, are really struggling for motivation, and don't necessarily see the connection between mathematics and the world around them. And that's why the book is named the way that it is. I'm hoping to open their eyes and motivate them to see and appreciate all the wonderful math that's really, literally, hidden in plain sight around us. So teenagers and people who are sort of early in their journey in learning mathematics, that's the first audience. But the second audience is actually probably in some ways more profound, because when I was at school, I didn't enjoy mathematics very much. I was one of those teenagers I mentioned. And I came to my understanding and joy in this subject much later in life. And I realized, having become a mathematics teacher and learning all these things, I thought, man, it would be great if I'd known these things earlier on. And so I've written this book very much with people in mind, who are adults who left behind math perhaps 20 or 30 years ago and probably have written themselves off. They probably said things like, oh, I'm just not a math person. This book is meant to be very keen and accessible. It's visual and inviting, and I hope that it sort of gives a new lease on life for people who wouldn't normally describe themselves as mathematical to engage with this subject and discipline.
Yes, that's something you often hear, isn't it? I'm not good at maths, more frequently than I'm sure you want to hear it. But when you were growing up, you didn't particularly like maths, as you just mentioned, and your parents, I think, didn't even want you to be a teacher. So what brought you around to being a maths teacher?
Yeah, so there are a couple of different pieces to that. I think the first part of the story was when I wanted to become a teacher, and I was at high school, and I still remember being sort of, 15, 16 years old, really trying to work out, what am I going to do with my life? And it sort of struck me that at school, most of the activities, the extracurricular sort of opportunities that I really enjoyed, they were the ones that gave me some kind of opportunity to be a mentor or a teacher, if you like, to younger students. I did things like peer support. I was an army cadet, and so when we had the younger recruits coming in, it was the responsibility of the older cadet to teach them how to do everything, like tie up their boots and pitch a tent and all those kinds of little skills that I found real satisfaction in teaching to younger kids. And so I thought, you know what, if I get a kick out of this and, have developed some skill in it, it'd be great to have a profession where I can use it every day. So teaching sort of became attractive to me in that way. And then the math piece, like I mentioned earlier, sort of came much later. I had the full intent to become an English and history teacher, actually, because those are the subjects I had much more a natural affinity for when I was at school. And so I turned up at Sydney University with that written on my enrollment form, Bachelor of Education, majoring in English and History. But then upon arrival, I found out that there's this huge shortage of mathematics teachers. This is 15 years ago. It was true then, it's still true now. And the reason why I wanted to become a teacher was not because of a particular subject. It was to make a difference in the lives of young people. And so I thought, look, if this is the area of need, if mathematics is where we have a shortage, then that's where I'm going to go. And so it was that was the thing that led to that watershed moment, which sent me down this rabbit hole of mathematics in the first place.
Well, I'm sure, Eddie, you're a maths hero to many out there, but I was wondering, do you have any maths heroes yourself? I'm thinking people like Gauss and or the ancient Greeks, Fermat with his last theorem. Do any of those sort of inspire your love of history of maths?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, probably a few names jumped in mind, but I think my first one that is immediate to me is maybe one people wouldn't think of necessarily as a mathematician, and that was Leonardo da Vinci. Now, the reason why I picked him out is because, you know, one of the things which I think that the Renaissance understood, and we have somewhat lost in today's academic perspective on things, is that, you know, in the Renaissance, they didn't have some kind of dichotomy between mathematics and science versus the creative disciplines. There wasn't, you know, they're the artsy sort of people and they're the sciencey sort of people. There was no division between those. And someone like, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, we call them polymaths, right? Because they had this diverse intersection of skills. Unfortunately, today, I think we've sort of fallen into this myth that there's such a thing as, like, I've got a maths brain or I've got a words brain, I'm a literacy person. And one of the things that I think is great about our understanding of the brain now is neuroscience does not back that at all. There is no physiological difference between the brains of people who excel in mathematics and those who excel in other areas. What differs is our attitude. So I love that Leonardo da Vinci just effortlessly combines all of those skills into one and just breaks that stereotype that you just one or the other.
You talk in your book at one point about the golden ratio, and I think da Vinci was one of these people that he was able to use the golden ratio in his drawing of the man with the outstretched arms. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that golden ratio. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So the golden ratio is a, well, it's, if you think about, we should understand what ratios are. If you picture a piece of paper, the, you know, A4 paper, you can see that it's taller than it is wide. And that ratio between the tall side and the wide side, that gives you a particular number. And you can divide this up for any different set of objects. But one of the interesting things is if you look out into nature, and if you also look out into a lot of human design and architecture, then this particular ratio, it's about 1 to about 1.6. So if you can imagine, you know, that piece of paper across the top, it's roughly, I think it's close to 20 sort of centimeters. And if you imagine sort of a longer piece of paper, it's about 32 centimeters. That's a bit taller than an A4 piece of paper. That is the ratio that we're talking about. And as you point out, Da Vinci, in his diagram of the man sort of outstretched on a circle and sort of putting his arms and legs out in different ways, we see the golden ratio in the various parts of the human body, which sort of makes you wonder, is this special number, this 1.6 roughly number, is it for some reason baked into the sort of the natural laws, the physical and chemical laws that have created the world around us? And the exploration of that mathematical idea is what that chapter in the book is all about.
And we're speaking today with Eddie Wu, who is the author of a new book called Wu's Wonderful World of Maths. So, Eddie, in March 2018, you were appointed as a super teacher by the New South Wales government. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, the the label is a bit funny. I don't like the self because it sort of suggests that I'm different in quality to the other classroom teachers who you find in schools around the country. I am just an emblem, if you like, of good teaching practice, which, as I mentioned, has been propagated by teachers around Australia for many years. But what my role is there to do is to help spread that good practice. So I'm still based at my school, Cherrybrook Technology High School, and I've been teaching a class all year as I usually do. But in addition to that, what I often am, the places I'm found in is other schools or conferences speaking and delivering professional learning to improve the practice and strengthen the practice of good mathematics teaching in different schools, primary and secondary, and also to run workshops and different sessions with students to help them engage with mathematics and experience it in a positive way. So that's what the role is all about.
Yes, look, it's. I think it's called for. I just look back on my own maths teachers many years ago, and I would never come out of a maths class feeling inspired, I'm sorry to say.
Well, unfortunately, Bill, that makes you approximately normal. It's a very common experience that you just described, and I think that's sad. I mean, a lot of people have said to me, oh, you know, you really make maths interesting, and I understand the intent behind it. It's meant to be a compliment, but I think maths is fundamentally interesting, and actually to teach it in a way that is driving Brian, boring is actually its own achievement, and it's something which we really need to fix. It's a wonderful subject that helps us understand the world in a richer and deeper way than we could have otherwise imagined, and for people to learn it as a very dull subject, I think is a mischaracterization of it as a discipline.
In your book, you put in simple language some topics that have always sounded pretty scary, like algebra and calculus, and there's a link to logic. You also talk about a maths proof being different from, say, historical proofs. What is the difference between those two types of proofs?
One of the things I love about mathematics is its ability to prove things beyond a shadow of a doubt. And it's not just a historical proof, though. We'll explain the difference there. It's also even scientific proof is very different in nature to mathematical proof. So maybe I can explain how they work by way of contrast. So what do we say, what do we mean when we say that something has been historically proven? Well, what we mean is we gather all the evidence up and we think about what is the one narrative plot line that goes through all of this which has the most explanatory power. You know, what is it that explained why World War I actually took place? Is it something to do with different powers that were, you know, in Europe trying to jostle with each other? Did it have something to do with Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his assassination? If we can come up with, if you like, a story that binds all of these different factors together and makes the most explanatory sense of the evidence, then we say it's proven. But of course, we might discover something new, some new piece of, some new artifact or some new account that sort of shatters everything. And this has happened throughout the modern world. We sort of had to rewrite and revise history and say, actually, you know what? We didn't understand this. We didn't have all of the evidence. Now we've discovered these new things. We had to revise what we thought. The same thing happens in science. We have experiments and we do them over and over again and we try and come up with an explanation that makes sense of what we observe when we repeat our experiments over and over again. But throughout history, we have continually, improved and designed better experiments and instrumentation that allow us to see things, perceive the world more differently. You know, I remember when we were growing up and trying to understand the way that the Hubble telescope changed our understanding of the universe and the fact that it was not just, static in place. It was not shrinking back. It was actually growing faster and faster and faster. And that was a theory which shattered all the different kinds of scientific proofs that we had once upon a time. So again, there's that revision of what we thought in terms of new evidence. But all of those stand in very stark contrast to the fact that in mathematics, once you prove something is true, it is true forever. And that's because it stands on the power of logic and deduction, which doesn't change throughout time. No new evidence that you can discover will prove to you that you can take any even number, and if you add one to it, you get an odd number. This is always true. If you have a right-angled triangle, then the square on the longest side, the hypotenuse, is equal in area to the sum of the two squares on the other side. There isn't another triangle that you can draw them for the rest of time, and we will never find a contradiction. So I think that makes mathematical proof unique and beautiful, and it's also a really encouraging thing, I think, and an assuring thing in a world where so many things are shifting and changing. In mathematics, we can find certainty.
Look, on that note, Eddie, and we're speaking with Eddie Wu, who's the author of Wu's Wonderful World of Maths. We ask our guests if they'd like to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which song you've picked and why you've picked it?
Yeah, look, I've picked a classic, at least in my view, which is Down Under by Men at Work. And for me, it's got a real sentimental value. Number one, when I was growing up, I just loved it as a song. Like, this is the kind of song I could just play on repeat for hours and hours and hours and drive the rest of my family crazy. But the other thing about it is, of course, the song is all about the quintessential Australian identity of it. Here we are, Down Under. We're very proud of who we are. And the reason why this has sentimental value to me is that earlier this year, as you mentioned in the intro, I was so amazed to be named one of the Australians of the Year. And I, growing up, I was born in Sydney and have lived there my entire life. I'm as Australian as, I can't. If someone asked me, where are you from? I would say, Camperdown, that's where I was born. So I feel Australian through and through, but when I was growing up, I didn't identify that way. I always had my migrant background, my parents having moved to Australia from Malaysia. I always had that as a huge part of my identity, and it took a long time for me to, actually see myself as a genuine bona fide Australian. So this song kind of, I really identify. I say, yes, this song belongs to me, and I think it's a wonderful way to embody Australian pride and identity.
Traveling in a fighter combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under? Where women go and men wonder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover. I said, do you speak my language? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich. And he said, I come from a land down under. From Peter Slow and Manchester.
Continuing the theme of Eddie Wu's chosen song for us today, we played a little bit of Australia's unofficial anthem, I Am Australian, written by Bruce Woodley.
We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And that was A Men at Work playing Down Under for our special guest today, Eddie Wu. Eddie, I think you play acoustic guitar. Do you see some links between music and maths?
Yes, I think that music and mathematics are so intrinsically linked that many people don't often realise it. In fact, one of my favourite quotes is that music is the joy that people feel when they are counting, but they don't know it. And, you know, there's so much rhythm and melody and harmony that is actually can experience and feel in your soul. I think that's what makes great music.
So, Eddie, in your book, a lot of your maths, I suppose, would be classified as applied mathematics. And I guess an example of that might be if you put a dollar sign in front of additions and subtractions to make it easier. Do you find it easier to teach applied maths?
I think that maths with a context often is much easier to teach because, you know, our brains have evolved not for abstract thinking, but for concrete thinking. You know, we want to solve problems, and that's really useful. But at the same time, I think there's this great power that mathematics has. One of the reasons why, as you point out, you know, you can think about numbers without a dollar sign. You think about something simple like the number three. What is the number three? You can picture $3 or three pencils or three cars, but the number three itself, it transcends that idea. It's a concept that is almost sort of ethereal. It doesn't exist in nature or in reality. It's just an idea in our minds. So while I find that context and that sort of concrete, you know, application of mathematics often an easier sort of starting point, I love that mathematics has that power to transcend that and allow us to use our imagination to solve problems that we haven't even encountered yet in the world, but mathematics helps us understand them nonetheless.
And in your experience, do you find that boys perform better at maths than girls?
In Australia, there is a well-researched and well-documented difference, a disparity between boys and girls' achievement in mathematics. I distinguish that achievement from ability because, you know, having taught many hundreds of boys and girls over my teaching career, I've noticed that girls are often much better at, you know, fine detail and proof and care and logic and elegance in their proofs. But one of the things that I often struggle with is the social aspect of mathematics, which most people don't recognize. In mathematics, it's really important to be able to make mistakes, to take risks, for things to go wrong, and then to be able to learn from those mistakes. And what I find is that often girls, because they are much more quickly and much more better socially aware, when they make a mistake, they're very cognizant of what people around them think and their view of themselves about whether they're a good mathematician or whether they are not. And that often leads to a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where girls will much more readily say, I'm not that good at maths. It's not really my thing. I'm going to focus on something where I have a more natural affinity. Where I'm able to encourage girls to press through that, I find they are some of my best students. And I remember in New South Wales, we have the highest course, which is Mathematics Extension 2. And I remember having a class where in the top 10, you know, seven of those students were girls. They are fantastic mathematicians, but they need a different kind of support, I think, to boys who are quite willing to make those mistakes and look a bit like an idiot, but still press on and learn through that anyway. So I don't think there's a difference in ability, but there is a difference in achievement, and that's something worth addressing.
Yes, and I think we are making some headway in that area just from what you hear. And as you say, in your top class there, you had a majority of girls, which will probably start worrying the other way now that the boys aren't doing the maths properly.
I think it's something that is really important because we want mathematical ability to be across the population, not just for some more than others. And it's the same thing, you know, often the reverse pattern is observed in literacy with boys. Boys traditionally don't achieve as well in English courses. And I think that that's an issue that needs to be addressed in the same way that numeracy does with girls.
And one of the areas where people perhaps think they have an understanding of maths and which can be disastrous is what you talk about in your book as gambler's fallacy. I wonder if you could enlighten us about the dangers of gambler's fallacy.
Yes, so for those who have never heard of it, the gambler's fallacy is, as the name suggests, a false kind of sense that if you are, you know, for example, taking a bet or you're at the casino and you've been losing game after game after game, the gambler's fallacy is, well, I've lost so many times, surely the next one's going to be a winner. And maybe not that one, maybe it was the next one. And this is how people completely drive themselves bankrupt. It is, of course, a fallacy because in games of chance, if, for example, I said, Bill, you and me will play a game. If you roll a six, then you win and I'll pay you some money. And if you roll any of the other numbers, then you lose and you have to pay me some money. You might think, okay, if I roll a whole bunch of numbers in a row and I don't get sixes many times in a row, surely eventually you'll get a six. It's true, eventually. But this is nothing to do with how many you have in a row. Every time you roll that die, there is the same chance, one in six, of rolling that six and winning. And that chance doesn't change over time. It's a fallacy. Our brains feel uncomfortable with the idea that we should be able to get ones, two, threes, fours, and fives over and over again without hitting a six. We feel like we should want to win. But, of course, the way the casinos make their money is that the chance of winning is so astronomically small that even after many hundreds of games, there is no increased likelihood that you will win on the 101st. So that's the game of fallacy. And mathematics can help us see through that lie and make wiser decisions.
No point in going to the casino with you, Eddie, as our maths advisor. We're not going to do any better.
I wouldn't be surprised if casinos around the country would put up my face on the wall and say, do not allow this entry, because the best way to win at gambling is not to play at all in most cases.
One other theory that you talk about in your book, which I found fascinating, is the Ramsey theory, where you'll eventually get some order out of chaos, because I've experienced what you talk about, that sometimes your iPod on shuffle will have five or six songs in a row by someone like Bob Dylan, and you think, oh, it must be a Bob Dylan day, but I've never understood how that happened.
Yes, this is a really, again, a counterintuitive thing, which is a whole branch of mathematics that you've just mentioned, which most people never even have heard of or never even touch because it's not compulsory in primary school or high school. And it's all about that idea that, you know, human beings, we are sensitive to patterns. And that's the way that we were born. You know, when you see two eyes and a nose and a mouth and two ears, we instantly lock in and we see a face. Even where there is no face, it's just an illustration, we kind of can't help but see the pattern. And so if you are playing, you know, I listen to music on my phone constantly, hundreds and hundreds of hours every year. If you listen long enough, eventually weird patterns like five Bob Dylan songs in a row will eventually come up. Our minds don't notice the fact that that might only happen once in a year. We only notice the fact that it does happen once in a year, and we don't think, wow, that's that was bound to happen eventually. We think, ooh, that was very unusual. So it's an outflow of the idea that we are much more attuned to patterns occurring than when they don't occur, and all the other random times where we just get jumble of songs in completely arbitrary order. So again, the mathematics that explores that, it can help us see things which are very counterintuitive.
And that's just one of many explanations and demonstrations in Eddie Wu's wonderful new book called Wu's Wonderful World of Maths. Much as I'd love to keep exploring this mathematics, which is so unusual that people want to talk about maths, but just remains for me now, Eddie, to thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Bill, thank you so much for your time.
And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.